Well, good morning and welcome to the Wayne Eddy Affair on your radio station. We are the one, 95.1 FM, and of course, for over 50 years, KYMN 1080 AM on your radio dial. An overcast day in downtown Northfield, Minnesota, a dreary day, if you will. No snow anywhere. Snowmobilers, sorry about that. People that make a living in the winter plowing, sorry about that. I've had one plow this year, or actually it was last year, last December. And I wish it would snow for all of those people that have snowmobiles. It is the 15th day of January, and the year is 2019 here on KYMN. And my guest this morning is a gentleman named Wendell Amason. And Wendell, I had an opportunity to chit-chat with you briefly before we went on the air. I like to call it the green room. And holy cow, do we have a couple of things in common right off the bat. And you know what they are?
Wisconsin, for one.
Three things. Okay. You graduated from what college?
Luther College.
Luther College in Iowa in 1964.
In 68.
68.
I have a high school of 64.
Okay. 1964 was high school. That's when I first started my radio career in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And in 1968, we put KYMN Radio on the air.
Oh, good.
So there are three things, four things that we have in common already. I was reading a brochure that I got from you, and it says, Artist Statement. I am interested in work that resides in both objective and non-objective worlds. I am equally attracted to the gesture and the non-descriptive mark, as well as the power and ambiguity of symbol and range, or image, excuse me. Painting inhabits a place between the known and the unknown. So we've established that you're an artist, and boy, those are all big words for me. But you were on KYMN recently, and I said, wow, this guy's interesting. Let's find out all about him. So the way I do my show is we establish who you are, and then I go way back to where you're born, and we have fun with all that and all the highlights in your life. So let's let the listeners know, what do you do today in the world of artistic objects and things and all that stuff?
Well, I'm a full-time artist. So
full-time.
I'm a painter primarily. Painting and drawing is what I have taught for 40-plus years. But
wow.
I retired from teaching full-time at St. Olaf College.
Okay.
Now 3 years ago. Coming up on four, actually. But it's sort of jokingly but realistically, I only have one full-time job now. Because as a college professor, certainly in the art department, I think that's across all of my colleagues in both Carleton and St. Olaf and public schools as well, because I taught public schools for 8 years.
Wow.
That is a full-time job. And at the college, my colleagues and myself, we are also expected to be active professional artists and scientists and writers and authors and whatever. So it was a fabulous balance for me. I loved can't almost use words to it. I really loved teaching dramatically. It was tremendous. It filled my spirit. I loved working with students and my colleagues. I had terrific colleagues. So for 38 years, I was actually at St. Olaf. Came in 78.
I think for the layperson like myself that I don't understand art, but I know it when I see it, that type of deal.
Yeah.
And I have to ask you, when people say, well, what do you do for a living? And you say, I'm a painter. And they say, you know, I need one this summer.
Yeah, right.
Does that happen often?
No.
No? Okay. Well, sorry.
That's okay.
I have had the opportunity to observe artwork at the Northfield Arts Guild. Are you involved with them at all?
Yes. I've been a member and a gallery associated with the gallery committee for almost the 40 years I've been in Northfield.
Okay. I probably have seen you at one of their meetings. I was at one about When do you have your annual meeting?
It's coming up soon, actually. It's coming up in about a month, actually, the annual meeting. But
okay.
I'm part of the gallery committee, so I've been directly involved in one of my former colleagues, but also one of my dearest friends, and Jan Shoger, who is a longtime resident of this community. We have hung every exhibit there, with the exception of the all-school shows. Thank goodness the teachers do that. But Jan and I have hung, basically designed and hung almost all of the exhibits for the last 25 years. So
it was either last year or 2 years ago that an artist from the Art Guild did a portrait of me.
Oh, yes.
And it was hung in a prominent place. And the first thing I did, and this is the truth, I went, wow, that looks like me. I mean, that is me. And then I started thinking about all the paintings or portraits, if you will.
Sure.
The dollar bills, $20 bill. I go, well, that's exactly what they looked like, even back in the 14th century or 15th. That's how they looked. And I always thought that it was kind of a made-up deal. So I was really impressed, let's put it like that.
Well, painting and all two-dimensional work prior to the invention of photography was the way that you described the representational natural world through skill and perspective, eventually in the Renaissance and so forth. So, yeah, it was a way to interpret reality, if you would, and through an artistic vision as well. So there's always a balance there, but it was representational. And once photography came around and so forth, and the late mid 19th century, 1850s, 1860s going forward, there became a whole different kind of, not an entirely, but a very much a multiple layered kind of conversation. So eventually abstraction of various ports and individual artists started taking on different points of view and so forth. So representation still plays a very important part, but it is not the only part anymore, as it used to be, per se, in many ways.
Well, take the painting of George Washington crossing the Potomac.
Yes.
That, you think that that artist imagined that, or that he might have been there and had a somewhat photographic memory?
I doubt he'd been there. I don't know when it was actually executed, unless you knew. Chances are that is invented in his mind about what he, through research, historical and otherwise, it is the way that he interpreted the historical event as Washington being this figure leading in front and being, you know, he might have been, realistically, he might have been hunkered down in the middle of the boat between his soldiers. Who knows?
Yeah.
But for the painting and the symbolism that it needed to carry, he is the leader of the nation and he's up front and whatever and going across. So nobody would know ever what it was, but that was the artistic vision to make a political, social, and artistic statement about the strength of Washington as a leader. So all of that is totally interpretive, I'm sure. It's representational, but was it an actual, the way the event happened? Chances
who knows?
Are not. Yeah. Yeah. It's like the joke that they do with the Geico commercial where they're pulling him across the street. Have you seen the Geico
commercial? Oh, yeah.
Where
I like that.
Pulling him across the interstate, right? Yeah. Well, they might have been pulling his boat. Who knows?
Yeah.
So anyway.
I present myself as naive in regards to your particular talent, and I just realized when I said, wow, you know, it really looks like me in that portrait.
Sure.
And I forget how many of the governor's portraits I've seen at the Capitol.
Oh, sure.
And I know who that guy is, and that guy is simply by the painting. So I take that back. I'm not as naive as I thought I was in regards to, well, I am, as I said. I got a question in regards to a painting that I saw in a castle in Denmark. And the guy that was giving the tour said, look at that portrait up there and look at it in different ways, different angles, and he will always be looking at you. I did that, and it was almost eerie that no matter where you went, side by side, facial, it was like he was looking right at me.
Sure.
Is there a name for that type of?
No, it's probably as much as somebody's interpretation, and they noticed it one day when they were walking around, and it became a really good hook. to capture the viewers. And yeah. But, many really effective portraits, part of it is teaching a viewer to focus. So pointing it out to you to say, look at that specific spot. It'd be like looking for me to look at the clock and say, notice the second hand is always moving no matter where you go in the room, and you're looking at it, and said, oh my gosh, it is. I can see it. Whatever.
Yeah.
So part of it is intention. Part of it is the skill / of the artist to create a strong representational image, I'm sure. But part of it is the way that the quote-unquote leader of the tour or whatever would point out. And once you see that and you can see it, you can say, walk into the Mona Lisa and you think about, oh, this is so amazing. And everybody thinks it's the size of this wall, right? But it's this tiny little thing. And you can say, oh, the Mona Lisa follows you around the room. Well, surely you do, because you're looking at her eyes. And so, therefore, wherever you move, you're focusing on it. And it seems like she's looking at you. She's not glancing off the side of the painting. She's looking out. So in this case, because the figure in the painting is looking, staring forward, as long as you don't move to a 180 degree angle, you're going to always have a sense that they are in some sense focused. So some of it is cliche, and some of it, sometimes there are unique properties, but did the artist intend that? 99.99% sure not.
Okay, now speaking about the Mona Lisa, boy, did you get that right.
It's a surprise, isn't it?
Oh, I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was a postage stamp.
Well, it is. It's tiny. Yeah.
Now, another thing that I did learn, and I did take art one time in high school, and we did fruit with chalk. Mm-hmm. I remember that. But anyhow, we went further into the Louvre, and I was at first, my wife wanted to see the Mona Lisa first. And I thought, God, we're going to go into a museum. And, okay. So I wanted to see it too. And so we started strolling through there. I was flabbergasted at the gorgeous, beautiful, deep, rich colors of portraits and paintings that were made in the, 15th century, 16th century?
Sure.
Where did they get those colors back then?
They made them.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, they made all their own pigments. It was all researched and hand ground, and everything was made by hand.
It's just beautiful. As a matter of fact, I was so impressed with it that you can't go through the whole thing in one day.
Well, you couldn't go through the entire thing if you took any time whatsoever. And I don't know what the figure is, but you probably could spend 2 weeks and not see everything. Per se. I mean, it is that much. I mean, you could just stroll and do the thing, and you'd probably do it in 3 days if you just walk nonstop. But as you probably have figured out, that the best way to go to any museum, from the Louvre to the Walker Art Center to the Northfield Arts Guild, is to go in and pick one piece. Just take one and go and literally spend 5 minutes, 10 minutes with it, and then that's it, and then potentially leave. You can, as a gallery as small as ours, you could circumvent it pretty quickly in 3-4 minutes or whatever. But if you literally wanted to see something and get value from it, is that you would stop and pick one piece and just stand in front. Make yourself do that and stand in front of it for a minimum, even of 2 minutes. Because even for the Mona Lisa, for instance, the average is, per viewer, is some ridiculous thing like 28 seconds or 35 seconds, because you walk through the entire museum to get there, and then you walk into the room and go, oh my God, there it is. And you say, let's see, Leonardo, I've seen it, boom, and you're gone. And most people do that. I mean, it's just the experience of seeing it, and then it's gone.
And the crowd.
And the crowd and everything else. But it's the average in most museums is that most people spend, for any one piece, on an average of 15 to 18 seconds, even a piece that they might stand in front of. So one of the ways I always encourage my students is to do a stroll, then come back and find one, and then go and make yourself sit there for 20 minutes to a half hour and take notes about it, draw about it. And once you do that, even if it's should be totally unfamiliar to you, sit in front of it, take time with it, look at it, and as representational or abstract it might be, but you will get it. That was a great, great comment from one of my dearest former colleagues, Arch Leon, who happened to hire me And it happened in about the second or third year that I was at Olaf. Maybe it was already the first or second year. But we were having a senior seminar in which the seniors were showing their work, and each group of 6-8 students would have a solo show, etc. And we were in, and as part of this seminar is that each group of students, let's say there were 6 people showing in the entire museum, and each person would have 6 or 8 pieces up, right? So it's a senior show. And then we would gather those seniors together, and they would have to make some comments about each other's work. So we're sitting in front of this one student's work, and he asks, let's say her name is Mary Jane or Bill or whatever, and he's asked Bill, what do you think of John's work up here? And he simply goes, there was silence for 20 seconds, 30 seconds, and he says, I don't know what to say. And Arch, in his wisdom, said, just simply describe it to me and you'll get it. You don't have to talk about what it means, how you interpret it. Just tell me what you see. Tell me exactly what you see and break it down formally. So does it have lines in it? What colors are it? We're looking at the sculpture that's in your office. So if I couldn't see it at all and my back was to it and I asked you to describe it, you'd have to start picking this apart. You'd tell me about how big it is, what size it's, what it's made out of, what colors are on it, what textures are on it. And pretty soon, beyond the fact that it's a 3-dimensional figure, you'd probably start looking at a variety of details, and you'd say, well, there's a face there, but it's not typical flesh tone, right? I mean, you could start describing it to me, and you would get something more out of that figure than you've ever probably gotten, and I would make you do it for 5 minutes and tell me every speck of detail. And the great thing about that is that there's never anything that you could notice that isn't important, because you will see it through your experience, through our 50, 60, 70 years of life, from your parents to your grandparents to growing up on a dairy farm to everything you've experienced. You will see something in there that you might notice that I would never have noticed, and because you just said, well, look at that one little scratch that somebody dropped once and put a ding on the arm or something. And I went, I didn't notice that, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So all those kind of details help give insight. And more importantly, it gives meaning to you, not to me, but to you especially, because you get to walk into that piece from your life experience, through all the things you've seen, through all the things you've known, and all of that is valid. So when you say, I'm an art novice, that's usually, for most people, that's a way of saying, I don't really know how to talk about art, and I don't want to talk about it because I don't understand it. And actually, in truth, you understand a tremendous amount. You've just never been asked to describe it.
No, I hope you don't find this insulting.
No.
But, nah. When you were telling me about this, I was thinking about buying a used car.
Yes.
And when if I'm selling or whether I'm buying, when the fella at the car dealership looks at it, it's amazing how, when you're selling it to them, trading it in,
right,
how they notice everything.
Absolutely.
Everything.
Absolutely.
And when you buy a car, you might. But when you have it, you don't. So I get what you're talking about. I just haven't applied it yet to the art world. And I want people to know that my guest this morning is Wendell Arneson. He is a entrepreneur when it comes to artwork. In addition to that, he is a retired professor from St. Olaf College, born in Wisconsin, educated at Luther College. And it's a pleasure to have you in studio. Thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
And since this is radio, we have to tell you about our sponsors, which include the QB, the Quarterback Club. Have you been there?
Oh, yes. Many
okay.
times.
What's your favorite thing there?
The donuts.
The donuts. Well, I think they're from Quality. I don't know for sure, but
They do them fresh. I also always interpreted that they made them fresh there in the mornings early, but maybe not.
Well, we'll just leave it at
that. We'll leave it at that.
Yeah. But although they could good. Because they have the deep fryer.
Oh, yeah. I think they
okay.
do.
Okay. Yeah. I never tried it.
They're usually gone by mid-morning, but typically I would pick up a couple dozen of those to my classes in the morning. Not often, but as a treat, some days and weeks, whatever.
And make other people disappointed because you took them all.
There you go.
Well, I always like to talk about their breakfast, which they serve until 10 o'clock each morning. And if you can think of a breakfast, they have it, whether it's a dry cereal, a hot cereal, or bacon and eggs, or pancakes, or waffles, and on and on and on. I don't think they serve grits. Have you ever had grits?
Once.
Did you like them?
No.
Okay.
That was in Alabama.
Yeah. I like them. First time I ever had them, I was down in New Orleans, and you want grits with that? I've heard that. Grits. Okay, let me try it. So it's kind of a weak oatmeal or cream of wheat.
Mm-hmm.
That's a quarterback club on Highway 3 and 3rd Street in Northfield, Minnesota. My guest this morning graduated from, we're going to do your high school years or college. College years.
College years, 68.
Yeah, okay. Let's see if you recognize this tune.
Surprise to me at the moment.
Number 10.
Oh, yeah. I recognize it, but I'm not good about recognizing artists.
Hi, everybody. I'm Archie Bell of the Thrills of Houston, Texas. We don't only sing, but we dance just as good as we
want. Like a real young James Brown.
We just started a new dance called the Tighten Up.
There you go. It's Archie Bell and the Thrills with Tighten Up.
Oh, yes.
Number 10 in all of 1968.
Yeah.
So here we are with a guest called Wendell Arneson. And, I like to get people to understand whom I'm speaking to. And once again, thank you for coming in. I do appreciate it. And when you find people like myself that don't appreciate art as much as you feel that people should, like you just explained, do you want to educate them, or do you think, well, they're missing out a lot?
No, they're not missing things. It's just a life experience, and sometimes you have time to do that, and sometimes you don't. Everybody has priorities. But it's also true that you may often hear the fact that said, oh, I could never do that, or I'm not creative, or whatever. Actually, when you think about creativity, really a wonderful electrician, a wonderful lawyer, a wonderful musician, etc. But lawyers, doctors, scientists, mathematicians, everybody's potentially creative in their own way. So it's just that for me, it's turned out to be a visual thing, but their creativity comes in many, many shapes and forms.
You mentioned that you study the artwork, and of course I studied that portrait, and I'm missing her name right now, but I'll think of it. You know what pinstriping is?
Yes,
okay,
sure.
On this portrait, I'm sitting on my motorcycle,
okay,
and I have pinstriping on it.
Okay.
Now, I don't think people would notice that at all or think about it, except I did, because I went, wow, how did she get that on there? And then she has the mirror with a reflection. And I'm going, what? Holy cow, that's amazing what an artist can do. Now, there are certain areas of artwork that people specialize in, whether it be portraits or what landscapes. Do you have one particular discipline that you work in?
Well, I'm primarily a painter. I'm an oil painter, but also I do mixed media drawings, per se. That it's hard to describe what I do, but prior to the last 20, close to now 25 years, I work primarily representationally. I grew up on a dairy farm. I grew up in Wisconsin and worked representationally until 1995 plus.
What does that mean?
Realistically, representationally, naturalistically, realistically, per se, quite per se, but not photographic by any means, but nonetheless you would say this is water, this is a stream, there's a piece of mine across the street here in the Northfield Library, a large water cut. Yeah, it's part of their collection.
A watercolor.
But actually, you can go down the street here and you can find a number of mine from the lobby of the Archer House to Neuger Communication.
Really? Wow. Good for you.
Well, no, it's
no,
it is
that's
what it is.
That's
but anyway,
exciting.
If you wanted to see something representational, realistic, you could go to the library and say, I want to see the Wendell Arneson watercolor, per se. And
how do you sign your paintings?
Carefully.
Well, do you use your entire name, or do you use...
No, I just use my last name. No, I use my last name, but it's very, very small, usually. It's just there as a copyright, but it should not infringe on the piece at all. So you'd have to hunt. You'd have to hunt for it.
Would there be a year?
Usually, yep.
Okay.
Usually, always a year.
Is it on the bottom right, bottom left?
Not necessarily. It is... Each piece, it's usually in a different place. But usually in the bottom, left or right, sometimes going vertically even, as far as that goes. So you'd have to hunt for it.
So do you ever hide them on purpose?
No, some artists do. There's a wonderful representational artist named Richard Estes, who is a photo, literally a photorealist, and did primarily these phenomenal storefronts, reflective city scenes, etc. And so... You would see both in, let's say it's a flower shop, and you're looking into all the signage outside the flower shop, just like looking at the sign here, KOIM, and somebody would doing a painting of you sitting in here. So you could see you inside, but also you'd see the reflections of the things across the street. So it's all this combination of complexity. Cool. And someplace he hides his name. And so it's a game to figure out where it might be on one of these tiny, tiny little signs that are in the window here, and he might have his name Estes on it, or running vertically, or reflection in the mirror, or whatever. So there's a game to find it. Yeah, it is fun.
Yeah.
But not many people do that, but it just happens to be.
David Allen,
yes,
local artist,
right.
And
yep.
His scenes are on Bridge Square,
right.
In Archer House, right. In the winter with snow falling. Mm-hmm. My wife loves him, so she has several of his paintings. And I think his are pretty much the common way, bottom right-hand corner.
Could be.
I think. It's amazing. By the way, maybe you can help me. I have a mission for you, all right?
Good luck with that, but anyway, all right.
Many years ago, I had a house over on East 6th Street. It's still there, big old house. And I rented the upstairs to a woman that was the archivist of Carleton College. And one day she came and she says, Wayne, I got this painting from one of the Carleton students I know, and do you want it? And I looked at it and I said, yeah, of course, it's a real oil painting. And I took it, and his last name, Dunn, and I think he graduated right around the early 60s, late 60s, I should say. I don't know when he graduated, but it's when you look at it and you do what you suggested and you look at it and you look at it, you see all kinds of things that's going on. When you first look at it, it looks like the death symbol going with the nightlight, you know, with the lantern.
Okay.
That kind of over, like when you just glance at it. But when you look at it, there's all kinds of things going on in there. Portraits, little heads here and there, and you can connect, and it's just amazing. Can you find out who that guy was?
All you do it these days, all you do is Google search it.
Well, all he knows is his last name.
That might be enough.
Oh.
You could just say last name Dunn. You can say artist colon Dunn. Even if you had an approximate year, you could probably go back to Carleton, actually. If you wanted to really know, you could just go to the registrar and say, this is the last name Dunn, graduated, I think, in approximately this particular year. Can you tell me his name? And once you find his name from the registrar at Carleton, chances are, if he graduated, in fact, then from there you could just Google search it and you could see if he's one. Some of us are still alive, or if he's still making work, or maybe he, after a year, he became a lawyer and he never picked up a paintbrush again the rest of his life. But anyway, that's the easiest these days. It's the easiest way to research someone. It's quite amazing,
yeah.
Actually.
I have to find it. My wife does not like it. It's spooky.
Yeah. Well, that would be the way to go about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I'd
good
just
idea.
Contact the registrar and ask him.
Okay.
Then you could get his first and last name.
I'm not a really good Googler.
Yeah, well, it's pretty... I'm not either, but it's pretty simple to do.
My wife can do that. It is already 9:32 on the Wayne Eddy Affair on your radio station, the 95.1 FM and KYMN AM radio. Wendell Arneson is my guest this morning, and he is a professional painter. Retired professor from St. Olaf College, lives in Northfield.
Yes.
And likes Northfield.
Absolutely. That's why we're still here.
I, Did you know, I was going to ask if Johnson from the Arts Guild, the director, last name, her name, Johnson, she directed many, many plays at the...
Myrna.
I saw her during Defeat of Jesse James days.
Sure, know her well.
And what a sweet woman she is.
Her dear husband who... Obviously, he was music director, band director at St. Olaf College.
Was it Mousy or?
Miles.
Miles.
Okay. I don't think he was Mousy.
No, no. I didn't mean that, but it came out that way. Miles. Right. Anyhow, so we have that in common. And I am going to go over to the Arts Guild and look at the paintings for more than a glance and check them out and see what I can see.
Well, right now, it's pretty amazing to go because it's the public school show. It's the Imagination Celebration, and it is floor to ceiling totally packed. There are probably 500 pieces in there from each school in Northfield, from Bridgewater and Sibley and elementary schools and kids from kindergarten right through seniors in high school. It is a celebration of Northfield Public Schools and the phenomenal teachers we have in this community. I mean, I don't know if you know, you should sometimes interview if you can. You can't get them away from their teaching, of course, to do this, but we have probably one of the finest public school art programs in our state, literally. We have a essentially full-time art teacher in every one of our buildings, which is unheard of in this day and age of budgets and whatever. But our community and our school board and our school systems have put tremendous value in the strength of our creativity of our young children and the quality of our teachers. And I am so incredibly proud of our teachers and what they have done. I've taught 8 years in public schools in Wisconsin when I first graduated, but to see what they have done, and a few of those folks are some of my former students, and they have tremendous programs. We have 3 full-time teachers in our high school, and it's unheard of in this day and age. So you should be very, very proud of what we are as an artistic community.
You suggest that I should interview an individual.
Yes.
Well, who's that?
Well, you could pick any one. You could pick a school. I mean, you might want to interview somebody from elementary, somebody from middle school, one of the high school art teachers or two. I mean, Karna Hauk and Catherine Norrie and Chris Holmquist, for instance, are the 3 teachers at the high school alone. But there are... Every building has its own. So it would be interesting for you to interview one of the teachers from an elementary school and get their perspective and what it's like literally working with 400, 500, 600 kids, every one of them once a week, for instance, and learning their names and having the creativity of all those folks. Our high school teachers and middle school to some extent as well are broken down by separate classes, and students can choose to take their courses. But in elementary, basically they're serving every single student who walks in the door in that particular building. And it is just the work that those kids do, the kind of energy it takes, the creativity that's involved is, and they give them a sense of history, a sense of place, a sense of time, and they have them think. It's not craft time. It's creative thinking time. And so the projects, I mean, I encourage you to walk down the street and go in right now. It's mind-boggling. And it's just, I'm so proud of them and their teachers and what those children do. And next Saturday, actually, here's a promo. This next Saturday, I think, is the Imagination Celebration. This coming Saturday. For the families, and they have a whole morning, early afternoon plethora of activities for families and grandparents and children, and it's just hundreds and hundreds of people show up because they're so proud of seeing, this is my daughter's drawing, right? Whether she's 6 years old or 16. And it's phenomenal, the kind of range of work that's done, the creativity.
I'll ask you a question. I don't have any children or grandchildren in the school district now. So what am I going to see and look at from a fourth grader that would hold my interest?
You need to just stop and look. Because they literally, I mean, there are a series of little figurative ceramic sculptures by kindergartners that are just of their dog, their own, their pet. They just not doesn't break your heart, just lifts the spirit of your soul. Just kindergartners. There are kindergartners in first grade work that is just outstanding. Just saw ceramic pieces, individually made, handcrafted. I don't know. We'd have to sit in front of it and look at it. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the fourth graders and the assignments that were given, and most all of them have a historical perspective. And if you thought about going to the Louvre and see the Mona Lisa, you might. Some of the teachers have given them assignments from a contemporary artist to a Cezanne painting from the Louvre, per se, and look at cubism and have kids in fourth grade interpret a still life, if you would, or some particular object or experience. And they have to use a collage format that incorporates a grid system or a cubistic system, and they're thinking about history and the Louvre and France and looking at their garbage can or whatever and creating this amazing things. It's the kind of thing that you almost have to go in because it's overwhelming, really. It is literally, Wayne, floor to ceiling, the entire place. There are probably 500, 600, 700, 800 pieces in there.
Wow.
But you almost have to go in and just say, I'm only today, you could walk down at your lunch break and take 15 minutes and say, this time I'm only going to look at the kindergartner's work. Or I'm only going to look at the work from Sibley School and then walk away. And next time I'm going to come back and look at St. Dominic's School. And next time I'm going to come back and look at the junior high school work. And then the next time I'm going to come back and look at Bridgewater's work, and only look at first graders or fourth graders, and going, oh my gosh, the inventiveness, because there's nothing that is prescribed. There's not craft time. It's not handprints. It's like stepping on a piece of clay and pushing, say, yep, here's my thumb. It's always incredibly inventive. There's a lot of thinking going on for all of those kids, and you will be just blown away by the inventiveness of first graders.
I'm thinking more of the artwork on paper.
Yeah.
And I'm picturing stick people. I'm picturing the sun rising. I'm picturing river in the brown in the grass. And, you know, just the stuff that you see in newspapers when they have contests.
Yep.
That's what I'm thinking. And
you're the wrong end of the spectrum. Go 180 degrees. That's why you have to go and walk and look. And you can talk about it later when you come back. And encourage other people to go who have not maybe gone, because it'll be jammed full of parents and grandparents, whatever, Saturday.
Yeah.
But I was just in the other day, and there were all, this was, what day is today? Maybe it was Saturday. It was Saturday morning, and it's not part of the big event yet. But there were 6, 8, 10 families already there, and their little ones and grandparents and whatever, and looking and celebrating their children's creativity. It's really quite amazing.
They have some that are displayed at City Hall?
Yes, they do. That's right. Yeah, it's a continuing evolution. It rotates quite considerably.
What do you think of the artwork they put in front of the library?
It's always a new piece. It's a big project to get that done.
And that one that's up there right now, wow,
yeah,
that is really fun. Yeah. It's abstract in the way that it isn't logical in regards to the length of the legs and the length of the body and all that. But if you look at it long enough, you say, well, that's not bad. That's the way they did it. They could have shortened those legs or put them higher or whatever. And
Of view. Yeah. It's materials and metal, and you look at it for how it's made. I mean, somebody, if you haven't interviewed, because one of my former colleagues and dear, dear friend, Mac Gimsey, I don't know if you know Mac or have interviewed him, but Mac is almost 10 years my superior, and he was an amazing teacher, scholar, international traveler, whatever, took like 30 different trips, he and his wife Jackie, around the world, but as a sculptor, and he is still making tremendous work. But he has worked with a lot of the high school students, both at Arcadia and at the high school, and has done a lot of sculpture, and he has helped do a lot of the public scale public works that students have done.
I'm glad you mentioned that.
So please see Mac.
I'm going to take a brief break. And then we'll come back on the Wayne Eddy Affair and rejoin our guest on Kim. We are a friend you can count on.
Hi, I'm Alyssa, director at the Vitalink Adult Day Center on the Three Links campus. Are you the primary caregiver of an adult living at home? Do you need a break from caregiving to recharge and do what you need or like to do during the day? That is where our program can help. We will provide a fun, nurturing setting for your loved one to thrive at. Vitalink Adult Day Center. Transportation is available. Call 664-8865 to learn more or go to 3links.org.
There you go. We're traveling. Paul Simon.
Number 8 in all of 1968.
Yeah. In many ways, it was just reading about what a tremendous, awful year 68 was.
Oh, yeah.
There were so many events.
We'll get to that. But this is Simon and Garfunkel.
Yes, it is. Mrs.
And,
Robinson.
Right. Plastics, young man.
Yeah, plastics. Yeah.
Mrs. Robinson, Jesus loves you more than you will know.
I think that's the first song outside of a church that they had on popular radio that mentioned Jesus.
Oh.
When you think about it.
Okay.
18 minutes before 10 o'clock on the Wayne Eddy Affair, and Wendell Arneson is my guest this morning. And here comes the big question. The first time I ever saw one of these paintings, I went, what in the heck is wrong with that guy? His name, Picasso.
Yeah.
So that's one you must have to study? I mean, not that one. Those that he did do that go for millions of dollars, who at first glance to a non-artist is like, well, that's just a bunch of scrambling. What's your thought on that, and what's the genius involved?
You have to look, Wayne. You have to describe. It's kind of simple as that. I mean, in some ways. I mean, he was a visionary. He was willing to take risks. He pulled together historical events. He pulled together multiple cultures. So he was really early on in his life, growing up in Spain, of course, and eventually moving to Paris. But he became also very, very interested in the strength and power of African art and the symbolism of it and the power of mask and the spirituality of it. So when he took the biggest jump and leap is in the painting, the D'Avignon, I can't even say the title. But anyway, His willingness to take risks, to see the strength and spirituality of African sculpture and the strength and the spirit of that, and wed it to Western culture and overlap that and raise questions visually about space and imagery and power and symbols. He just kept pushing the envelope. And every single piece was a degree of research, which I think most of us or most artists who are engaged in the work they're making, it's not mechanistic. I would describe for myself personally, but I think when you think about Picasso, every piece, though it might have a lineage to it, each piece was a degree of research. Each piece was a different kind of question. And I think work that is effectively well made doesn't give you answers. It gives you questions. And if you're willing to take the time to look hard and say, what kind of question are they asking me? It may not come easy to you, but most all creative, inventive work that pushes the envelope a little bit is, in fact, asking questions. The artist is asking questions not only to you as a viewer, but they're asking questions to themselves about what's the next thing I could figure out? What's the next question I can ask? Because otherwise it does get mechanistic. And I can tell you that from a personal perspective is that
First describe mechanistic.
Being like a machine.
Okay.
Just so to give you an example, I mean, for 20 plus years from 76 to 96, I was a watercolorist primarily and worked primarily representational. In other words, what you see is what you got. But over a time, it would got so that, and I still think, and even in the piece that's here in the library, I still feel proud of what it was and what it is, and the way I produced it, and the kind of ideas that I had about the vision, the way I thought about water and space and color and the atmosphere and the environment and yada yada yada. But it got to a point that once I had an idea of a particular image, and I drew it out slightly to give myself a place to start, I could literally start in the upper left-hand corner and go and over a couple days or whatever. And when I got to the bottom right-hand corner, I was done. I could figure it out how to do it. Does that make sense? So it's like building a car or working on an assembly line. So that making a piece became like assembling. Put this piece and this piece, and this is the technique I'm going to use, and I can make this, and it's going to look like this, and I could figure out in my head what it was going to look like before I started. And that was a mantra that ultimately became really important to me, was the fact that you start simple, whatever that image might be, and create a conversation with what's in front of you. And you don't know where it's going to go. You discover what it's going to become. You discover what it means ultimately in the end. You have a seed, you have an idea where it starts, but you also move to someplace different. And that's, in some sense, if you go then back and say, well, what the heck was Picasso doing? Well, in some ways, he was just each piece he was making responding to his family, to his wife, to his mistress, to the world around him, to the Guernica and the bombing of that small community in Spain. He was responding to these horrific, in that case, events, and he was trying to make sense out of it and make a comment about it. But he worked on this tremendous scale that he had never worked on before because it was such a huge, powerful event. And he took the risk to work and rework and discover and change and alter and push until it became this magnificent piece, maybe one of the single most magnificent pieces ever made in some respects. But he took risks. He tried things that he didn't know where was going to end up. He had a seed, an idea about how he was going to go, but that's where it ended up. And so I think most interesting work ultimately does that. It pushes you as a viewer to ask questions.
I kind of thought that, a couple of thoughts here. Number one, the people interested were, because it was avant-garde, as they may say. His most famous painting, and I don't recall the name of it, but first thing I thought of was either a queen in a deck of cards or Cleopatra.
It might have been both. But see, you think of that because that's part of your experience. And he would say, and I would say to you, that's a valid comment because it enters into your lexicon, your life experience, whether you're a card player or you know about Cleopatra. And he would not be, I would not be offended by that at all. It's just a way that you enter the piece because it reminds you of one of your life experiences or maybe multiple experiences, and you bring together everything from a deck of cards to Cleopatra, and that's okay. You need to give yourself permission to say, that's okay that I respond that way because that's how I enter it. So in my own personal work, I'm interested over the last especially 20 years of creating multiple kinds of entrance points. So there are different ways you can read it, different ways you can interpret it. And I give you permission to walk into, to stand in front of something for 2 minutes or 3 minutes and then describe it. You could do this with your wife, actually. You could do it with a friend. And it's the way to really look at work is that you need to have your friend or your wife or a good friend stand with their back to the piece and then you describe it to them. And if you describe it well, you will get it. But you will get it in relation to your life experiences. From starting and growing up working in a radio station in Wisconsin 50 years ago to what the weather was like yesterday or the color of the sky today. All of those experiences count. And they are valid. And you need to give yourself permission, as it does everybody else, to say, If you see it and you describe it, you'll get it. You won't necessarily get it the way the artist thought they were going to do it, but that's okay.
You know, that's interesting because years ago there was a really strong JC organization in Northfield that did a lot of wonderful things for the community,
yes,
including buying the first rescue squad for them. And there was a seminar on comprehending what people are saying, and what they had is they had all of the fellow that was speaking went to the back of the room, so the people were looking forward.
Okay.
And he had to describe
yes
something.
Okay.
And they had to draw it. And when you got done, you gathered up all the drawings, and holy cow, that was amazing. The difference between and mine was absolutely correct.
Yeah.
And the guy across from me, no, no, this is the way it is.
Exactly.
And it turns out it's interpretive.
It is.
And there is a thing called interpretive art, right?
Well, as I would suggest,
is that kind
you,
of the
no, as
level?
I would suggest, you all good work and work that has significance or meaning to you is in fact interpretive, no matter how quote unquote realistic it might be or how abstract it might be. It should in fact be interpretive, and it will be interpretive for you, because it still could be a beautiful sunny landscape of a beautiful, let's say it's a field with sunshine and golden flowers and whatever, but you will interpret it because you remember last June or August or when you were a kid, because you grew up on a dairy farm or whatever, walking through those wheat fields and said, oh, I remember with my grandfather walking through those wheat fields. So that's interpretive, right? Even though it's could be very photographic, it's still, if it's really effectively made, it has something that will resonate with you, and that's where the I think all good work is interpretive.
We are talking to Wendell Arneson. He is a former artist. Is that the word I used? Art instructor,
right. Art professor,
professor. Excuse me.
That's right.
At St. Olaf College, and also retired and still in the business of pleasing himself and audiences with his. Paintings, and they're available for viewing in the Northfield Library and probably other places in Northfield. We'll get to that in just a minute. We'll be right back.
A home is probably the biggest purchase you'll ever make, and you want to make sure everything goes smoothly. Call me, State Farm Agent Mark Quinnell. I not only offer homeowners insurance to protect your investment, but I can help with home loans too. No wonder more homeowners trust State Farm than any other insurance company. For information, call me, State Farm Agent Mark Quinnell, at 645-4545. Providing insurance and financial services, loans are offered through State Farm Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Residential or commercial, Cannon Valley Water in Dundas is the place to call for water. Whether it's a complete water conditioning system or just salt delivery and filters, Cannon Valley Water can take care of it. And Cannon Valley Water can also deliver Candy Yohai premium water right to your house or business at great rates, too. Chippewa Springs is as pure today as it was when we first tested it over a century ago, and is proudly distributed by Cannon Valley Water. Pickups are now located at 609 Stafford Lane in Dundas, just behind Aldi. Call Cannon Valley for your water today.
1968.
Sitting in the morning sun.
Otis Redding.
I'll be sitting in the
sitting on the dock of the
bay.
Yeah. It was number six in fall of 1968, the year you graduated from St. Olaf College.
Luther College.
Luther College, I'm sorry.
I taught at St. Olaf.
Keep me straight.
But it's one of the probably the single biggest reason I ended up at St. Olaf College is because I went to Luther.
Yeah, and there's quite a few kids from Northfield that go to Luther.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's kind of a good deal for the children of professors.
That's
because
right.
They can exchange... less expensive tuition, etc.
Right.
Okay, I'm not going to be able to tell you his name, but you'll know who I'm talking about. And I'm going, what? And that's the guy that put a canvas on the floor and
Jackson
just threw.
Pollock.
I knew it had a European name. Pollock?
Pollock.
Yeah.
Jackson Pollock.
And I'm going, I can do that.
Maybe you could, but you didn't.
He
was
that,
the first one.
Is that the whole point there?
It's part of it at the time. Yeah.
Aren't people foolish, you know, considering paying a lot of money for what they could do themselves?
No. Well, if you could do it yourself, you should go do it and see if it works out as well.
Well, he thought of it.
Yeah, that's right. He was the first.
Yeah.
Thinking. And so he was thinking about the space, the textures of it, the energy of it. It was part of the whole abstract expressionist movement that was the outpouring of the inner soul and meaning to be gestural and not figurative and not tied to reality, but the experience.
Did
so
he,
the experience is what was important.
Did you see the movie?
Yes.
Okay. Was he insane?
No, he wasn't insane, but
weird.
He was possessed. He had a lot of personal demons. He was, but he was an incredibly inventive guy. Yeah.
Did he ever do anything that wasn't so off the map?
Oh yeah, I mean he started. He could draw as well as any representational painter when he first started out. Just like Picasso. I don't know if you've seen any early Picasso pieces, but he would have drawn your portrait and it would have been dead on, absolutely photographically real. So all of, they have a background in representation, most of them do, and Pollock did his own. He was also very, very interested in cross-cultural kind of activities and influenced a lot by, and of course we're talking now separate by almost 50 years plus from Picasso to Pollock. So you're having a lineage of all this work that goes on. But Pollock also became very interested in spiritualism and was strongly influenced by Native American totems, poles, Native American art, patterns, symbolism, masks. Not unlike how Picasso was interested in African culture and African masks, Pollock saw that over, in my interpretation anyway, and I don't know if this is true, but I think it is, he saw that overlap too. Well, he saw the overlap culturally. So he initially had drawing skills as well as anybody, but he also saw the power and symbolism of Native American work. And so that's a lot of his early work. I mean, you should go back and look at, when you think about Pollock, then do a little, go back and research and look at what he did when he was 15, 16, 18, 20 years old, 25 years old, 30 years old, and look where it led him to the kind of space and the, just the energy of what he tried to do and so forth. So, yeah, it was, he's an interesting guy.
Now, another one that I'd like your opinion, and we only have a minute and a half before the news coming up, so I'll make an easy one for you, because people are familiar with him, and that's Andy Warhol.
Sure.
What's your interpretation of that? The first time you look and you go, a can of Campbell's soup? Big deal.
He was just making a comment about it. Art is around us everywhere. Daily life. You need to just pay attention. He's just, with that, in some ways, pop artists were doing, pay attention. Life is, art is every day. Every day is art, the kind of combination of those things. So he was just making a comment about, simplistically, much more so than that, but nonetheless, he was saying, pay attention. You know, and the commercialism, and he was talking about many, many layers of things, and I'm Warhol scholar. But
did he the portraits of Marilyn Monroe?
Oh, yes, many, yeah, many famous
where they
people.
Were different shades and different colors right in the row. I thought that was interesting because I could relate to it. But a can of tomato soup from Campbell's, I knew what they looked like, but I couldn't relate to it.
Well,
you know?
There you go. You've never bought Campbell's soup?
Good.
Yeah, well, there you go.
We are listening. Thank you. You are listening, and I am listening to a gentleman by the name of Wendell Arneson, a local artist, a former professor at St. Olaf College, now retired. And we will be back after a brief break for the news on your radio station. We are the one, 95.1 FM, and at 1080 on your AM dial from beautiful downtown Northfield, Minnesota, the home of cows, colleges, and Wendell Arneson.
Minnesota News Network, I'm Tasha Radel. The president and Congress remain at an impasse, and in the meantime, the partial federal government shutdown, now in its 25th day, is having an impact on Minnesota. State Management and Budget Commissioner Myron Franz says there are many unanswered questions as to how some workers, farmers, and programs in the state will be funded.
Minnesota depends on federal government funds. This state receives approximately $1 billion a month in federal grants. For example, Medicaid, highway funding, TANF, temporary assistance for needy families, veterans health care, food security programs such as SNAP, and school lunch. Anytime a significant funding partner is shut down, I become concerned.
Governor Walz is expected to give an update on how the state is addressing the shutdown later today. A Barron County, Wisconsin judge has set bail at $5 million for 21-year-old Jake Patterson, accused of kidnapping 13-year-old Jamie Kloss and killing her parents. District Attorney Brian Wright noted during Patterson's first court appearance that he made elaborate preparations for the crime.
Wiped down the shotgun that was located at his house and the shells that were used to kill James and Denise. It is alleged he shaved his face, all of his head hair, and showered before leaving for the Kloss home. so no DNA or fingerprints could be located.
Investigators say Jamie was a secret captive in Patterson's home in Gordon, Wisconsin, even as his father and others visited. She escaped after nearly 3 months and encountered a woman walking a dog who led her to safety. Minnesota's law enforcement community is honoring slain Duluth police dog Haas. The canine partner was killed by a suspect in an officer-involved shooting Sunday night. A procession of Duluth squad cars transported Haas for cremation last night as people lined up along Grand Avenue. Police and sheriff's departments across the state are remembering Haas on social media. This is MNN.
You know this one yet?
Oh, yeah, the Beatles.
Name it.
When I get older, losing my head.
I can sing, almost sing it. So it's the. It's from Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Yep. A birthday greeting, bottle of wine.
Yes, there
you go. Here it comes.
Would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me?
That's the title, When I'm 64. Mm-hmm. And the reason I play that is I started radio in 64, and I was 64 years old when I started doing this particular program. So wow, that's the connection there. My guest this morning is artist Wendell Arneson, and Wendell is educating me right now, and I certainly do appreciate it. And I can be somewhat opinionated about some things, like, for example, Pollock. What about the... You see a display about the size of these sound repellents, and they're all one color. And they're in a museum, a big museum.
Yep.
I mean, can I rip that off the wall and bring it in and say, hang this? I mean, what's the story behind that? What's your thinking?
Well, part of it is history. Part of it is... the fact that, as I talked about earlier, moving from representation, moving through photography, going through early 20th century, going from Picasso through abstract expressionism, there's a lineage. And eventually, artists tried to literally pose more questions and say, that particular piece, which may be all solid blue, is saying... it's solid blue to you. It's solid blue also to the same person in Vietnam or China or Russia or wherever. It's trying to make, is this a universal, can I make a universal piece? Maybe in some respects. They literally move from how dense something could be, how layered, how representational, and even then Pollock, how incredibly layered and complex and busy. Could I take all of that away? Could I take it all away and give you Pollock's black and beige and tan? Could I give you a whole piece that's just black? And you thought about it and say, oh, my gosh, that's sort of creepy. It's kind of scary. It's all black. Or is it all blue? And what? And then you could say, well, what color blue is it? Because I'm looking behind you, and I'm looking at you with a bluish teal, greeny, gray shirt, but I'm looking at two different blues behind you, one on the panel and one on the pot. I'm saying, well, what if the whole panel was that one color blue? How would it be different if it was the color of the pot of blue above? So it's a matter of, they literally tried to minimalize it. Then so there was a whole movement, and to some extent, that still sort of coexists today. And that's why we don't have one movement that follows after another. So that's what it did from early 20th century until almost the 70s, if you would. There was one reaction to when it got super quiet that somebody else would make it super busy. When Pollock did his drips, somebody made it solid blue and took it all away.
Is that called a minimalist?
Minimalist.
Yeah.
Minimal.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you get. That's all you get. And so then you're forced to say, well, can I find meaning in that? Well, it's looking out at that red car. And so it's the difference between those two. Maybe they're identical, two identical cars sitting in front of us, but they're very different from each other. One's red and one is silver. But minimalist. They took all that away. Now, instead of having one follow and reacting to against the other one, now you've got 50 different things, and they're all going simultaneously. So you have minimalism, abstract expressionism, representation. Most all art that you might see in a museum is kind of combined, literally overlapped. And you could expect to find something that is representational, believe it or not. If you go look at a contemporary museum, even like the Walker, you'll find some things that are potentially even photographically real, but has a question about what the image is or why it's there. And you'll also have potentially something that could be 6 by 20 feet in solid blue. And all of those are raising a question. And you have to be open enough to say, what does that, in this case, you know, what blue is it? Could I describe the blue? If somebody said, well, is it light blue? Is it dark blue? Is it intense? Does it remind you of the water? Is it the sky? Is it whatever? And that's how you might enter it. But it's going to bug you because, oh, I can do that. I can go down and get a can of spray paint and whatever and make it. Well, maybe you could. So, therefore, maybe you can go home and make your own work and make one big piece of canvas and make it meaningful.
Did you notice how I'm asking very simple questions on a limited basis, so of things that I have seen or know?
Oh, absolutely.
What about the guy that had the crucifix in a urinating scene that was, you know what I mean?
Yes.
I can't remember his name, but that was very controversial.
Oh, absolutely.
And what was the whole point of that? Dissing Christians or...
It was raising a question, wasn't it? It made you remember it.
I was offended.
Yeah. Well, it made you raise questions about at what level is something artistic or at what level is something so politically, socially... is there something that is so taboo that it can never be done? And I'm not trying to justify whether he did or didn't and whether or not I do or do not like it or whether I do or do not find it meaningful. And I would suggest to you and any viewer out there, see if you can take the word like out of your lexicon. Just cross it off. It doesn't exist. Do you find it meaningful, irritating, just downright disgusting, or challenging, or irritating, or exhilarating, or whatever? What are the words you could use besides like or unlike? And then if you can, then you can find a way to actually describe it and find out why it is so irritating, why it is challenging, and what norms does it challenge. And it did, of course.
It created feeling.
Absolutely.
I mean, right down to hatred.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's okay because, in some ways, I don't know if it's okay, but it is okay. It made us then say, this is not appropriate. I don't acknowledge this because I have it doesn't match up with or it pushes all my buttons of a value system that I think is meaningful. And it doesn't have to be realistic to be art, but it does. This is making a statement about social, political, spiritual, religious, all those layers are being thrust in your face to say, well, then speak up about it.
Okay.
So the person, again, was raising a significant cultural and religious question.
Did he ever sell that?
You know, I honestly don't. Probably.
Okay. Here's the one. This one will be dear to your heart, and I'll gesticulate rather than mention the painting. What is it?
You're talking about Edvard Munch's The Scream.
Yeah.
Wayne's here stepping back and giving me the wide open mouth screaming look without actually bellowing it out. Yes, sure. Edvard.
No, that looks like a fifth grader painted that. And yet it's one of the most popular paintings of our century, 20th century.
One of the hundreds of, yes, sure. No, what Picasso would have said to you, his goal in his work was to be as significantly, simplistically, powerfully with content as much as a child. Because children don't draw from reality. Children draw from emotion directly. There's no, if he wanted to have a child draw a scream, can you imagine what it would look like? It would be a circle with a great big hole or whatever, a circular shape inside the face, and would you get it? Absolutely. So Picasso's comment about his whole life's experience was, it was a comment he made once. I don't know how often he might have made it, but his one of his goals was to be as clear in idea, and he was wanted to have his work be as powerful as that of a child. Because we all have these norms that things have to look realistic to be powerful. Well, you remember the scream. You remember the image.
Well, my wife's Norwegian.
Well, but it doesn't make a difference. If you've seen it once, you bring it up.
Amen.
So therefore, the idea, the scream, is cemented in your lexicon because it is that powerful. And so therefore, his statement is memorable to you. And so therefore, maybe it's the most one of the most significant pieces that you have in your memory.
Yeah.
Because you remember it. You remember the image. You remember the how the mouth looks. You remember where it's placed and this figure on a bridge and whatever. But you remember the face.
Yes, I do.
And therefore, it nails content.
And
there's nothing obscure about it.
I remember Grandma Moses.
Sure.
And her great painting.
Well, yeah.
And it was.
Great, yeah.
Let's see if I got it right.
Well, Whistler's Grandma Moses, you mean? Or Grandma Moses, the Whistler's mother, are you talking about? Or are you thinking Grandma Moses as in the artist and all the, maybe I'm not even saying it right, all the pattern and decorative kind of landscape?
I don't know what I'm talking about.
That's right.
and I enjoy people that do. That's why
I invited
you to be on the guest. But I have probably the wrong painting. I'm thinking about the Iowa farmers with a pitchfork and a dull look on their face during the depression.
Well, one of my dear colleagues at St. Olaf did a lot of his research based on that piece. And I'm going to go brain dead, and you're throwing this at me, and I can see the piece, of course, and whatever.
The pitchfork and the whole bit. Yeah. They did a
American Gothic.
Yeah. So is that art?
Sure it is.
I mean, was that painted?
Oh, absolutely. Was it painted? Yeah, it was painted.
But it looks like a photograph, almost. Almost.
Yeah, it's representational.
Yeah.
Sure.
So the expression on their faces, which were non-existent, was hard to do, I would imagine.
It was a good Iowa farmer.
Yeah. So is that, Gendre, your American art, deep in your heart, or is it...
It's not deep in my heart, but it might be deep in others.
Sure. Well, what I wanted to get to at 14 minutes after 10 o'clock on the Wayne Eddy Affair, my guest today is artist Wendell Arneson. And boy, how many times do people say Anderson?
Yes, they do. When I first came to St. Olaf, they were introducing me as Wendell Anderson. It just rolled off.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Because he would just
getting into it. Yeah, he's a friend of mine.
Oh, yes.
And he was our lawyer on... the Minnesota Broadcasters Association.
I see. Yeah.
Because I'm not that familiar, but appreciative of the great artists in the world, particularly the vivid colors and the battle scenes and different angels ascending into heaven, and it's just amazing. Who are your favorite artists, and what is a Renaissance artist, and what do you call people 500 years ago? And modern artists are called what? I mean, do you put them in little slots?
We used to be able to categorize people. You don't categorize them so much anymore. And like I said, literally the last 50 years, there's not one kind of – it's not impressionism. It's not representation. It's not Renaissance related, there's not a lexicon that exists currently. So you could say, actually, we don't even call it modern anymore, because there was a whole movement called modern art that was something that was always pushing the envelope from one style to another style. Now it's pluralistic, so it's going on all over the place. So if you ask historic, I think we were just talking about this, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago, about who are your my daughter and I actually were maybe the comment was asked to her, or she asked, brought it up, and we were saying, well, who are your favorite 4, 5, 6, 8, 10 pieces? And I thought, well, that's really actually a hard question. And it would almost have to, you'd probably have to do it by time period rather than just say, I value Michelangelo more than Picasso, more than Jean-Michel Basquiat, who was one of my favorites and currently has already passed away. He died when he was only 28 years old, but he's a phenomenal creative.
How did he die?
Drug overdose. Yeah, in New York. But one of a lot of people.
Can I interrupt you for a second?
Sure.
Do you think that people that smoke pot or inject a foreign object in the form of a drug-related incident visualize when they're stoned, for example?
I have never been.
But do you think that there are artists that they only can produce what their hallucinations present?
No.
No?
No.
And some of those crazy things that they do?
No.
No?
No, I think it comes from another place. It comes in from their experience and their soul, and doesn't just simply, not that it could have been produced and some vision happened to them because they either were or were not induced by some kind of outside force / drug or otherwise, but did it take them to make really interesting work? No.
Okay. Class of 1968, St. Olaf College. Wendell, I interrupted you. Do you recall where we were?
We were talking about favorite pieces.
Yes.
So I had to look back and think about how far back do I go and where do I start that lineage of interesting work, and do I go to Egyptian tomb paintings, which are really, really interesting. But chances are I probably jumped to Michelangelo, and most people would say Michelangelo's David or the Sistine Chapel or whatever. And actually, I go to the Michelangelo's Captives, which you may not be familiar with, but in Florence, the David has its Michelangelo's David, which you probably at least have heard about or know about, is in its own separate museum. It's in this big rotunda. It's a gorgeous big thing, and it's probably 14, 16 feet tall, this large marble piece of David, per se, that Michelangelo carved. But leading into this space, in this rotunda, there's a walkway of about, as I recall it anyway, 50, 60 feet long, narrow corridor. And on either side of the corridor are 10, 12 blocks of marble, in which some people think, he started these figures but never got a chance to finish them. There are probably 6 or 8 on each side. You walk through them to get up to the David at the end, which is this under this light and gorgeous and this big sculpture. But along the way, there's something called the Captives. And they are sculptures. It would be as if this piece that's standing behind me is actually only a third done. There's a big block of marble around it, and you can only see the face and part of the body sticking out of it. And these figures are twisting and pulling and pushing and elongated and twisting, but they're literally never set free. They're stuck in the stone. Therefore, what one of Michelangelo's comments was is that all you had to do in order to make the sculpture is just carve away the excess and they'll be free. Well, this particular 10, 12, 14 pieces, which you should look up, called the Captives, is that they were never let loose. He carved it in many ways, surface-wise, gorgeous on the outside, but he only did a third of the figure or the fourth of the figure. So they're still locked in the stone. For me, those are way, way more powerful and meaningful and tension and poetic and ambiguous and mysterious and any word you want to put on it than, for me personally, David ever has been or was. Once I saw those, I just, there's the David. I walked around it. Okay, fine. Then I went back and spent the next couple hours with each of those figures stuck in the stone. It's just off the charts gorgeous and magical. And
I didn't get to that, but I bet you that's in the book that I bought.
Ah, well,
I'll have to look through it. I always savor the idea to look through that book in a lengthy amount of time with being trying to be perceptive of different things, and I haven't done that yet. It's kind of like a dessert of my life when I sit down and really think about
this. So you have a book on Michelangelo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, on the Louvre.
Oh, and these aren't in the Louvre.
Were they?
They're in Florence.
Florence, you said that.
Yeah, in Florence.
Okay. I haven't been there.
Yeah, well, it's a gorgeous place.
Yeah.
You can walk.
Yeah, that was the powerhouse for many years.
It was the center of the art world.
Yeah. 22 minutes after 10 o'clock, my guest this morning is Wendell Arneson. And Wendell, does anybody ever call you Wend?
Nope. When I was in college, my only nickname was Arnie. Which I treasured because at the time I had just started playing golf, and I share a birthday, affectionately with Arnold Palmer.
And are you as good?
Oh, yes, obviously. That's why I'm an artist and not a golfer. So, a professional, that is.
Now, when you say you're a professor of art at St. Olaf College, do you get into all mediums, or are you specifically canvas?
My teaching experience there was primarily two-dimensional, so I taught drawing, design, color design, and painting primarily. But when I got out of undergrad school for 8 years, I was a public school teacher. So the first 4 years I taught in a small school, Highland, Wisconsin, which was out 60 miles west of Madison. So you know that area of southern Wisconsin. It was a town of 700 people plus or so, and we had like 50 students per graduating class, etc. But I was the art teacher from, I helped out K through 3, gave some advice to the teachers, but I didn't work with them. Then I had fourth and fifth graders. Just one day a week, had junior high kids for 3 days a week, and had two high school classes. But I was also.
What years were those?
68 to 72.
And you were that close to Madison?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, boy.
Oh,
did you ever go over there?
Oh, yeah. I'm a Wisconsin boy, so I grew up right outside of Madison.
I mean, did you ever go over there during all of the unrest and the person that was murdered in the buildings on campus?
And
Well, that had to be something. You know,
it was a powerful time.
It is 10:25 on 1080 radio, and we're going to take a brief break, and we'll come back with our guest here on Kim. And I got an idea I want to share with you, if I may, Wendell. So let's listen to what's available right here in Northfield, Minnesota. Listen up.
Has your path been leading you towards a career in urban planning? Well, here's the opportunity you've been waiting for. The City of Northfield has an opening for a project manager in the Community Development Department. This two-year position is well compensated with an excellent benefit package. So if you have a degree and experience related to urban planning and community development, make the right choice for you and for your community and go to the City of Northfield website and click on Employment Opportunities for more information about the position and details on how to apply. The City of Northfield is an equal opportunity employer.
Pardon me?
Good tunes in those days.
Yep. This was The Rascals.
Oh, yeah.
And it was number 5, and it's called People. People Got to Be Free. Another protest song. And Madison was a hot spot.
It sure was.
Yeah. What I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to set up an opportunity for, as I mentioned to you when we were talking before we started our program, that I want to, you know, start with where you were born and then bring you all the way up to Northfield 2019. However, we've been in the art part for an hour and 25 minutes, so I'd like to invite you to come back and start with where were you born and how did you end up in Northfield. Is that okay with you? All right. So let's keep talking about art. It came upon me as you and I were conversing. The St. Olaf is considered a liberal arts school, correct? Is that still the terminology used today?
Sure.
And well, I'm thinking that you have people, students, that are clumsy, and that's just the way it's going to be. I'm sorry, I cannot paint, period. Amen. But is more of your job education and appreciation of that particular discipline, or do you actually have to be hands-on to pass?
I taught studio, so I taught, except for the very first year I was here, which I taught contemporary art history, which you probably should have taken. It would have been a good thing. No, I'm a studio art teacher, so I teach two-dimensional media, drawing, mixed media drawing, multiple materials on paper, and teaching students both watercolor techniques and oil painting techniques and whatever. Some of which are, and by the way, everybody, and I mean you, you just need to have me as your teacher, everybody can make work, and everybody can make creative, inventive work. It doesn't mean that whether or not it is quote-unquote realistic makes it work. That's where I was using Picasso as an example, wanting to make work like a child that has content. My basis of teaching beginning drawing was to say, yes, I need to be able to teach young men and women appropriate skills to be able to figure out how to interpret something three-dimensionally on a two-dimensional surface. In other words, be able to do your portrait, be able to draw the fan, be able to draw a car, whatever it is I chose to have them select, to be able to make it look, relatively speaking, how to create a three-dimensional object on the illusion of on a two-dimensional page. That's one. It's a skill. It's not an idea. It's just a skill. But it allows you to have a background that says, if I wanted to do something representationally, three-dimensional on a two-dimensional page, I have the skills to do it. So whether it's a car, it's a landscape, it's a person, it's a duck, whatever it is, I can do that. But that doesn't make it art necessarily. It makes it a representation, it makes it an interpretation of life on a 3D thing on a two-dimensional page. What makes it become more than that is how you enter it, how you use that skill to create an idea. So then I will have them, students, make things that are representational, then I'll have them make something that, oh, heaven forbid, Wayne, be solid blue on a big piece of paper, and they have to figure out, what could I make solid blue on a piece of paper that every 21 people in the room would make it different? So they make it with a stick, they make it with toothpicks, they make it with their finger, do they make it with a piece of wood, what color blue is it, how did their texture and surface and whatever make it somehow unique to them? Is it a dusty blue-gray, is it the blue of a July sky, or is it a blue of a January sky? Is it a blue of a sky that is almost today, which primarily overcast, but there's just a dusty little teensy bit of maybe a smidgen of blue up there. So you could create a time of day, you could make a season, you could pick, you know, whatever. All of those are a plethora of ideas of just being that thing. So is that more valid? Is that an idea separate from? So I would have students in a 14-week semester, I would give them a different kind of assignment from 2 by 2 inches to 3 by 3 feet every week for 10 weeks. And then at the end of that 10 weeks, I'd say, which one did you find most meaningful? Which piece of this? And maybe it's a piece from week 2, and it's a section of week 6, and this particular piece of charcoal was better than this particular kind of color because I didn't really enjoy, I didn't find color meaningful. I found the black charcoal a lot more engaging. So the last two and a half of the weeks, everybody would make their own particular statement about what they found most meaningful. And some would make 6, 8, 10, maybe 20 or 30 pieces that were only 3 inches big. And some would make 2 or 3 drawings that were 3 by 4 feet. Both of them are equally valid. And one might be very representational, aka realistic. One might be that big blue wall. Anyway, and they would then have to articulate why they found that to be meaningful. So in a sense, my goal for all of my students and how you can, quote-unquote, teach art is to help students find what they find valuable from their life experience. What do they find? Maybe some of them are also scientists, biologists, chemists, whatever. And when my favorite class in high school was biology. I didn't have a high school art teacher. And the reason I loved it so, not only the science part of it, but I got to draw. I didn't have an art teacher. So I got to draw all of the stuff that was in the book, and I got to draw all the things through the microscope. And I still have that particular little journal that I made when I was a sophomore in high school, because it was an intersection between science and something visual. And so a number of the students at St. Olaf, as an example, and Carleton will be this too, a number of our, at least at our beginning classes, and even through senior exhibitions, there will be an intersection for them between their multiple passions that they find throughout their 4 years as a college student, but even where they grew up. How do you intersect, and how do you find out what is meaningful, and how do you find what part of your life experience can you make visual work about that you find most engaging? And that might take a place and might be a three-dimensional piece. It might be made out of clay. It might be made out of clay and digital film. And it can be any number of combinations. But it's how each student finds meaning in their own life and what they find academically interesting besides making simply using the techniques part, the drawing part, the photography part, the sculpture part. How do I intersect those ideas? That is really one of the most, it was the single most exciting part for me as a teacher, was not teaching technique. It was giving them permission to find out what they valued in their life, in their family, in their personal life, what they saw and how they interpreted that. And that became magical, and it still is to this day. Go up and see a senior show at our two colleges, from Carleton and or St. Olaf, and our high school students. They have an honor show coming up in May. And already those young men and women are given permission and the challenge to find what they find unique and different in their own life. And that is outstanding. It's really fun.
I was wondering, when a student wants to take an art class,
yes,
at St. Olaf, do they have to have had experience in high school?
No.
Or do they want to be an artist in one of the disciplines that you taught?
Well, it's interesting there, and I'm sure that's true of my colleagues in Carleton as well. At beginning level, we have a number of beginning level courses, and at St. Olaf, at least, there is a quote-unquote a distribution credit that each student has to have some kind of quote-unquote fine arts experience, and that can be in poetry, it could be in literature, it can be in visual art, it can even be in art history, it can be in theater. Students who choose to do a studio course, whether it's sculpture, photography, digital, or in my case, drawing or painting, some of them, probably, if I gave you an estimate, about 50% of those students had some experience in high school. Some of them had a lot of experience in high school or grade school, whatever. But probably a good third to half, either they were in a size of school where they didn't have an art teacher, or they were so busy, which often happens to most kids, they just didn't have time to fit it into their academic schedule in order to get into a strong institution like our sister institution, Carleton or St. Olaf or Gustavus or whatever. They had to figure out all the academic things they had to fulfill. So they didn't have either time, or there wasn't somebody in their school or whatever. They had one course, they didn't have any. And some have had two, three, four courses. It doesn't make them any less creative at all. It just, their opportunity didn't exist. So some of them will come to college with the fact that, I never had a chance to take psychology in high school. It didn't exist. I always thought it would be interesting. I didn't get a chance to take ceramics, or I didn't get a chance to learn how to draw. I always thought I wanted to do that. I loved it, but I didn't have that opportunity in high school. So this was their chance to try it. Some will find that that becomes an incredibly important part of their education. Some will find it so important that they even decide to potentially keep going with it and maybe even major in it. And some will just want to have that kind of experience, and they'll take one and say, that's okay. If I was my preference. I wish that every single student had the time and we had the resources to have every single student do an art course, because I believe that everyone has that capability. It may not end up being realistic per se, but they have everybody has ideas that can be interpreted visually. It's just a matter of working through the kind of parameters and problems you can set up to make it do so.
I understand that.
Yeah, so it's really exciting.
I wondered if how much time is split between classroom sit-down lecture and on-hands action in the studio.
It's a different for different kinds of courses have different kinds of hours. For studio course specifically, most all studio courses have 6 hours direct contact in class. Usually it's either 3 days a week, 2 hours 3 days a week, like Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 2 hours, or Tuesday, Thursday, 3 hour sessions. And for us, and I think that's also for my colleagues at Carleton, it will be, you would expect that they, whatever number of hours they have in class, they will spend the same amount of out of class. Now, saying that, you will have a certain percentage of your students in any given class will do somewhat less than that, but probably not too much less. But you'll also have some who get so excited about it, you might have 6 hours in, they might spend 12, 16, 20 hours out if they, you know, get really, really passionate about that particular thing. But in general, as a general rule, it's kind of 50% in and 50% out. And that doesn't always work out that way, but it depends on each individual student.
As a liberal college, of course, you want to introduce your students to the world. And so if a person wanted to become a painter, for example, rather than an individual that says, I think this will be an interesting education for me to learn the arts and also even to learn how they do that. I can't do it, but I can at least try. Is there, do kids like say, hey, you know what? You did a great job, and I'm going to go off to an art school. And you probably know where they are and what they are. Does that happen with kids that, young people that think they're really talented, and some school will invite them to participate in a program that's considered really, you know, big deal?
Well, there are multiple ways to get an art education, and those are decisions that somebody makes usually in their high school career, and they decide early on that I prefer to go. There are multiple routes. So you could, there is everything from a technical school, there's an art school. Usually state universities in general have less requirements outside of the art field than often, like, for instance, our sister liberal arts college here and throughout our MAIC, for instance. And but for us, a student chooses to come to a Carleton or St. Olaf, and I'll just say St. Olaf, they choose to come to us for their art education. If they're interested already in pursuing it, they choose to come to St. Olaf because they're not only interested in art, but they find they're also passionate about science, philosophy, literature, film, theater, music, whatever, and they're looking for that intersection. Some of them will continue on that art track and find those intersections, and some will find that they actually end up being more interested in biology or math than they are in the art. And some of them, my daughter as an example, is both a studio art major and a math major. And you'd say, well, why the heck does that happen? Well, she's incredibly inventive in both. They're just two different ways of her to see and think about the world. And she's good at both, and whether or not she will, in her life, follow one track exclusively over the other, we don't know yet. She's a senior this year. My other daughter, Mari, didn't do art coming up in my family. She didn't do art in college, but she became passionate about languages and about political science, and she's visually really articulate and a good designer, but her passion finds its creativity someplace else. But she's wonderfully creative, incredibly creative, but it isn't visual. But anyway, the reason you would come to St. Olaf versus going to the College of Art and Design, which is where your question is because there are two different ways of achieving an end that helps you find the multiple places in your life that you're most excited about. And some people know right away from high school on that I want to be a quote-unquote a graphic designer or a filmmaker. And they might choose directly to go to an art school that has a specialty, really a strong program in film, because they know exactly that's what they want to do. We have an outstanding film program, as it turns out, at St. Olaf. So a number of our students will find their way to film, but they're also taking things in, mm-hmm. literature, philosophy, and all the other things, so that they have a rich blend of multiple experiences, academic and visual, that elevate their art experiences for them. That's really important. So there are multiple ways you can do it. One isn't better than the other. They're just different. And all of those are individual for each individual student.
I think the big takeaway is appreciation of art, whereas you taught me today what to do when I'm looking at a painting, a very, you know, minor situation. It just, you tuned me into that. So now I'm going to have a better appreciation when I go through the Northfield Arts Guild.
I hope so.
So we're take a break, and we're going to get off the subject of art here. We're going to get into the subject of, wow, have you got the guts to do this?
Let's rodeo! The Cinch, world's toughest rodeo, presented by Ram Stampedes, the XL Energy Center. January 25th at 6, the stars of pro rodeo. Whiplash, the cowboy monkey, and Saturday night only see CMA artist Travis Denning in concert. Come early for pre-show fun. Tickets start at $20, and kids are half price at Ticketmaster.com. Like us on Facebook, save $5. The Cinch, world's toughest rodeo, more than an 8-second ride.
You know what I was just thinking? Whiplash was right here in Northfield, Minnesota during Defeated Jesse James days. The monkey that rides the dog. We've had him here for a couple of appearances. So I just thought that I'd pass that along to you. Do you know this song? My guest graduated from St. Olaf College in 1968, and this was the number two song in all of 1968. Wendell Arneson, Name That Tune. Pardon me?
It's from a fabulous movie.
You got to lean into the mic there or bring the mic to you.
That's okay. Tell Me. It took me by surprise. It was a great time.
That's the title. I Heard It Through the Grapevine, number two in all of 1968, by Marvin Gaye on the Wayne Eddy Affair on KYMN Radio. I have a question. At 16, before 11, you indicated that you can be creative with math. Math is black and white.
Oh, no, it isn't.
Okay, but this, I got to hear this, because 2 plus 2 equals 2 no matter how you do it.
Well, I'm not a math scholar, so you should but have my daughter here to talk about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, well, but you have some insight to that.
Well, absolutely.
How can you be artistic with math?
Well, it's not about – well, it is artistic. It's just that the great mathematicians, any mathematician, is incredibly inventive. They're problem solvers. So visual artists are problem solvers. They set up their own problem, if you know what I mean. So it's like saying, well, you asked me to go – ask me right now to sit here and do an image of the library across the street. So how would I interpret that? It's a visual problem. Mathematicians create equally, maybe far more complex problem sets that allow an incredible amount of layers of complexity and inventive solutions. So it's, I don't understand what my daughter does. I mean, once I've heard her give presentations, I understand her telling her name mm-hmm. and maybe giving an example of the fact that she grew up in Northfield, Minnesota, and she can speak for 20 minutes, and I have no clue what she's talking about. But she understands it terrifically and understands the problem set of what's set up in front of her and how she comes to a variety of creative solutions. So that all the things that the things that are sitting in this room, both are designed by somebody, but your control panel, the computers, all of this was somehow invented by an incredibly inventive, creative, mathematical mind,
okay,
per se. And so,
good explanation.
I don't know if it's a good one or not,
but
mathematicians. I was saying, I mean, great lawyers are also very inventive.
Yeah.
And so are doctors, lawyers, and plumbers, and all the people that we know. And you go down to Witt Brothers and you say, I've got this problem with my car and the thing won't start and whatever, and it's not obvious what it is, and they will figure it out.
Yeah.
Because they're inventive and understand all of these things that is like, no, we're not driving a mechanized vehicle anymore. We're driving a computer, right? So it's phenomenal, the kind of craziness that everybody in their own way, whether you're a botanist or a mechanic, needs to be incredibly inventive. You need to be passionate about that particular field. And if you are, you will set up amazing solutions and amazing problems. So I'm amazed by my daughters in what they find passionate and how they come up with creative solutions.
And that leads me into my next question. I think, do you know Bob Will?
Yes.
He, of course, had been a guest of mine many, many times. And one of the things he does during Carleton's homecoming,
okay,
a lot of students look for him, call him, want to see him, want to discuss things. And so part of the job that you enjoyed for many, many years is results, and I should say our results, in that they keep in touch occasionally, either through the homecoming weekend or whatever, and that's where a lot of pride can come from being a good professor. Do you have any students that did go on to make a living in the art world?
Hundreds. Oh, absolutely.
Oh, wow.
Well, here's the example. I mean, it's pretty simplistic, but just look around you and understand that every single thing in this room you can see, touch, feel, even what you breathe, is designed by somebody. Now, think about that. I mean, looking out the window, the street, the cars, the windows. I have one of my former students is one of the head designers of BMW. In Munich, Germany, as an example. But a number of them also are mechanical engineers, and some of them are graphic designers, and many of them are architects, and some of them are fine artists, and some of them are teachers. I mean, a number of my former students are teachers in our public school system in Northfield, as an example. But so that everything you see and touch is designed by somebody, literally.
But is there a distinction between being a painter and a designer?
Not really. I mean, it's all visual. I mean, there are different degrees of what you use to put bread on the table, I suppose. But sure, there's a distinction of how you use your visual skills, and some will choose to do it in a quote-unquote commercial basis, or whether they're designers in a traditional sense, working for a graphic design company or an architectural firm or whatever, whereas somebody is also doing their art-related skills in quote-unquote fine art, if you want to call it that. And if they're doing fine art, maybe they're also teaching or they're doing some other aspect. And many of young men and women will have a day job, whatever that is, working in a radio or being an auto mechanic, because they're good at it. But they also might be a sculptor or a filmmaker or a painter, and the 6, 8, 10, 20 hours a week, as well as doing something else. So there's a certain amount of money that they need to make their living, but they're also passionate about making their art that is individual. So there's a huge balance, but thousands of them.
And there's infamous poor artists.
Yeah, sure.
Now, I committed a mortal sin in my book when it comes to broadcasting. I didn't reintroduce you after the break. And people tune in and tune out. They get in and out of their car, whatever. I am talking to Wendell Arneson. He lives here in Northfield. And we're going to have him back. We're going to talk about his upbringing on the farm. But I have a question that I get to ask so other people should or should not ask. All right?
Okay.
All right.
And I may or may not answer. How's that?
Well, okay. So here you are, a creative person. You've had many paintings. Some hang locally in City Hall, for example, the library. You sold your paintings. What was the biggest price you got for a painting?
I won't answer that.
Is that should a person never ask an artist that?
Well, I think you can if you're interested in coming to a studio and wanting to purchase a piece. You can say, how much is that particular piece and what is it worth? And there's also a timeline that goes, just like any artist work would have been sold for X amount of dollars 25, 30, 40 years ago. The piece in the library is as valuable to me now, looking back at what it is and when I did it, as a piece that I might do this week. It's just different. But there will be hopefully some some increase in value over that time. So it's been an interesting, rich journey, rich as in experiential.
Yeah.
But it allows me to pay the rent. Let me say that.
Oh, well, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
And a lot of materials, and because I have a separate studio. I don't have a studio in my home. I have a separate studio here, actually downtown, over just down the street, overlooking Main Street, at the McGaughy Building, right above, well, across the street from Bierman's, top floor. So
Up
on the top floor. A number of us as artists are up there.
Paul Smith is your landlord?
Right. That's right. Yep.
So when I go look at the painting in the library,
yes,
and I go look at the painting in the City Hall, what am I going to see?
You won't see the one. No, there isn't one in City Hall, because those rotate, by the way.
Oh.
All the paintings.
Well, I assume they did. Yeah.
Yeah, they all do. The one in the art. There are three in the Archer House, for instance. So
what are they? So when if you tell me, I'll look for.
Oh, the one in the library is a representational piece. It's a watercolor, half the size of your panel here, of water.
Oh, okay.
But looking down into water. And that would have been from 1980, actually. So now almost 40 years old. The ones that are in, or the largest one, when you walk into the lobby of the Archer House, is actually more abstracted, but it has layers of Northfield in it, from water images to, I mean, you'll have to go just interpret it. But it's a combination of a different kind of color palette, textured. It's made differently. It has a whole different format from the one that's more representational in the library versus the one that's in the Archer House.
Do you have any other prominent displays in other communities?
I have a fairly wide range of public and corporate collections across the Midwest, primarily. So,
well, that's got to be a thrill to walk into an office building and go, "Hey,
I'm there."
Or do you know everybody that sell your paintings?
Well, I do for the most part. However, when you're affiliated with I'm affiliated with three different galleries, per se, that represent me, one in Minneapolis, one in Wisconsin, one in Des Moines, Iowa. And they do sell works to a variety of different kind of both corporate and private homes. I may or may not, once the piece is gone, it's gone someplace else, and I very rarely see it. But I do get a chance to see some in various places.
I have a couple more questions. 5 minutes before 11 o'clock. We're going to take a final break on the Wayne Eddy Affair. I'm talking with Wendell Arneson on KYMN.
Hi, welcome to this Subway ad for 5 foot long starting at $4.99 each. How do you want it?
Secret DJ set.
At a retirement home?
Weird, I like it.
DJ sandwich in the house.
What'd he say?
Cold cut combo $4.99.
Gold butt mambo.
Meatball marinara $4.99.
How much?
$4.99.
Limited time only at participating restaurants. Prices and subs included may vary. Additional charge for extras plus capital tax. No additional discounts or coupons may be applied.
Okay, now it's your responsibility to record that and then slow it down to see what he was talking about. 5 minutes before 11 o'clock, hey, Wendell Arneson is my guest on KYMN Radio. Do you know a guy from Northfield? I believe he lives in the area still. Dirk Hansen? Okay. Have you seen the drawings, artwork of the infamous raid on the First National Bank.
Sure.
Well, then he's who's done that.
Oh, I see. Okay.
He's the guy that did those. And those are pretty prominent in this community.
Yes, they are.
And, I'm real proud of them.
They're beautifully done.
Yeah. So I'm getting, I auction off the original art. Well, First National Bank bought the first, the original art. And then we had
reproductions.
Yes, and I auctioned off the first five to raise money for
sure.
Defeated Jesse James Days, and Dirk was commissioned by the First National Bank, and we're proud and happy that they did that. Point number seven, have you ever had any of yours artwork reproduced?
No, I don't do reproductions of work. They're all originals.
Okay.
Only originals.
I mean, you would, is that a sin to?
No, it's not a sin. It's just a choice.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I haven't had made reproductions of any pieces. It's been requested. But
yeah, that's what I was just going to ask. Yeah. Somebody said, I would like that, but somebody else owns it.
Right.
And isn't there money to be made by reproducing?
Oh, I suppose. Could be.
Yeah. We have a photographer in town. He's a former coach at Carleton College, maybe St. Olaf. Heavyset guy, Jim is his first name, and he took a picture of Nurse Strand's falls, waterfall.
You're talking Tim Larson.
Yes, Tim Larson. Thank you. I've talked to so many people. It's hard.
That's right.
But anyhow.
It's a beautiful piece.
You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, I know the piece.
I bought one.
Okay.
I look at it. I look at it every day when I go through a hallway.
Sure.
It just amazes me. It's so real, but he had to have some photographic ingenuity to do that.
Interpretation.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So I just thought I'd throw a couple of
local artists
in for you.
Good for you to have a piece of Tim's.
And I cannot, and I've got, who's the guy that lives out on 246?
Fred Summers.
Fred. Yeah, I've had him on here several times.
Sure.
I don't have any of his artwork
yet. Well, you should break into your checkbook and go get a Fred.
Well, I was thinking of maybe if you have framed or canvas without frames that you have leaning against the wall from 1968 on up to now, imagine you have a big sale on that someday?
I don't know if there will be a sale of those. I try to keep a piece once a year as sort of a lineage of mine. I don't know if it's going to be literally that much, but to be invited eventually to my daughters, and they will probably end up having to sell because there are too many out there at this point that I've tucked away. But I try to pick one a year because it's significant to me as a next step, a new question that was raised that year that seems to be paramount, that seems to be successful for that year that was different from the year previous. So I try to save one of those a year. But as you can imagine, doing work for 40-plus years, that means 80 pieces. Now, I don't know if I technically have 80 pieces, but my daughters are going to have to figure out what to do with all of those.
You've already agreed that you'll come back, and then we'll find out how you ended up at St. Olaf College and as a professor and learn about your other experiences on the farm.
There you go.
But, question, do you have one painting, because they're all original, and there's only one, do you have one painting that is your favorite or all your little children?
No, but I think I know what my wife would choose. We have one in our home that I did now 10-plus years ago. It's fairly large. It is as big as this panel that's on your wall. It's by 5.5 by 6 feet.
Gee whiz.
But it's of my wife teaching our daughters how to swim.
Oh.
And it is abstracted. It's changed. It's two different sets of images. It's called tubes because they used to have those styrofoam tubes for swimming.
Yep.
And they're in the piece and whatever. So it's the one my wife refuses to let me take out of the house and exchange it for other large
pieces.
Now,
was that done from a photograph?
It was done from a photographic source, actually, but there were two different photographs, and I turned them upside down and cut them together and pieced them together. So, and then it was totally changed. So it was used that as a starting point.
And should I tell people your address and they can come ring the doorbell?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, let's make a date and have you come back and find out what you were like as a kid.
Yeah, you can talk about the Wisconsin Badgers then, because most people know me in Northfield as the guy that wears all the Badger red gear.
And you mentioned Mauston.
I did.
I worked for WTMB. Toma Mauston Broadcasting Company.
And that's because I taught at Wisconsin Dells for 4 years.
Oh, yeah. I used to go down there for the races all the time.
Yes, sure.
Did you ever do any race scenes?
Did not.
No? Okay. Well, thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Wayne.
We'll make a date. You're listening to The One. By the way, that was Wendell Arneson. He'll be back. Wendell Arneson. You're listening to 1080 AM Radio from downtown Northfield, Minnesota, and
95.1, the one station where you won't hear the same songs hour after hour.
Twitch. Sometimes I swear this body's got a mind of its own.